Welcome to our show, Examine Life, on KKRN at 88.5 FM in Bella Vista at Round Mountain.
I'm Steve.
And I'm Pat.
Plato said that the unexamined life is not worth living. On our program, we examine different aspects of life and human nature. And Pat and I have decided we're going to discuss the 20th century.
The social impact of the 20th century, that makes us what we are today. And I think we need to go back and revisit that and see 100 years ago, Europe was an important part of the world on the world stage.
Well, no country lives in a vacuum. And what we want to talk about are the different decades of the United States and how each one affected the decades to come and how they affected us in our social life and our culture and technology and the things that were invented. And all of this is interrelated, and it's a fascinating study on human nature.
And it ultimately leads to our political position today and our viewpoint of the world.
It does, and we don't realize sometimes how much we're affected by technology. We think about how we affect technology, but not how we're affected by it. And when I say technology, that includes the invention of the wheel, a saddle for a horse. All of that is technology. It's just become different in appearance now.
And I think if you go back to, say, 1900, England ruled a fifth of the globe. And that's impressive when you consider that Europe was on the center of stage. Paris was the center of culture and arts. And those kinds of things we don't remember, I don't think.
And we weren't really seen as a world power back then. You know, when we look at the movies and the old Twilight Zone programs and so on about the first decade of the century, we think, you know, about a quiet time with straw hats and bands in the park. But we were seen around the world as just another nation, and that prompted us to have the Great White Fleet that sailed around the globe was really a demonstration by the United States that we are here and we're going to protect ourselves.
And that happened in 1907. But if you go back even to 1903, that's when the first Nobel Prizes were awarded, and that was science and literature. The big social impact on us was the immigration. We had 35 million immigrants come to the United States by then.
And we didn't realize in 1905, when Einstein's first part of the theory of relativity, and later on in the 1920s, our GPS devices today that we take for granted could not function without his mathematical equations.
Yes, and everything gets built upon by something else in science and technology. Our social impact is much slower and much smaller. It's in baby steps. If you look back, moving pictures were just starting in the 1900s, and that was unique. That was a new technology, but it was also entertainment, which we didn't have a lot of.
Right. The telephone brought us direct communication, but the movies, the radio programs, those brought us new forms of entertainment, which we didn't have before. We had the roaming, you know, the players that would do drama plays in various towns, and we had books that we could read. But there, you know, other than singing to each other in our rural homes, there wasn't much entertainment to be had.
And 1901 is when the Oklahoma Territory was bought from the Indians. We didn't steal it. We bought it for $2 million, and it was 64,000 square miles. And some of those Indian chiefs actually reserved huge 160-acre plots of land for themselves. But we didn't steal it from them. We bought it. But we allowed settlers to actually go out and start developing that in acreage, and they would eventually, we called them squatters at first, but they eventually got ownership to that land.
So what that says to me is that I can't believe that politicians other than white European politicians are so full of graft and corruption that they would have giant plots of land at the expense of their own people.
But again, it goes back to, I hate to relate it to politicians, but it's politicians that had the foresight to buy this land. Of course, the ranchers wanted them to do it, and the railroad people wanted them to do it so they could extend the railroad and have big, huge cattle ranches without the problem of Indian slaughters.
Well, that's, you know, I know you don't want to talk about politics, and I'll try to restrain myself, but it infuses everything. Politics have been around since the first caveman was stronger than all the rest, and the other people wanted to suck up to him so that they could be safe from him, and he would use his strength to get them food. I mean, politics is a part of all of human nature.
And world politics at that time were extremely aggressive. The Boer War in South Africa was going on, the Boxer Rebellion in China. We had Russian czars who started violence against workers who wanted better working conditions. The Russian czars were already campaigning against Jews, especially in even other countries like Poland. So it wasn't a peaceful time ever.
No, and I think that's human nature. If you go back to the beginnings of biology, you know, it's always been about competition. And so human beings are just another expression of that. It's interesting and sad how Jews have always kind of been the target. And I guess it's because they were a people without a nation, and yet they were a people. Well, pretty much every other culture had a nation somewhere back in its past, but the Jewish nation was just too far back.
And it might be. I'm not quite sure why they were always targeted, but we had a lot of things going on in the world that I don't want to say we were oblivious to, because we had newspapers. But America was primarily rural then, so you didn't go into town and buy a newspaper every day, and there wasn't the newspaper boy that brought you one. So we were a little distant from what was happening in the rest of the world.
And where a lot of news today is performed inaccurately, but back then it was fundamentally inaccurate, probably, because it wasn't recorded and sent to us that way. It was written down by someone who interpreted it, and that was copied or written down by somebody else and put in a newspaper and embellished by them. So by the time it got to us, it's like the periodicals of the Old West and the heroes and so on. By the time it gets to us, it's given as news, but it's even warped at that point.
And journalism was, when I took journalism class, it was who, what, where, why, and how. And even today's newspapers don't cover all of those, but back then they did. But yet you had to have it in a small column. Only so many words were dedicated to each story, so things were truncated.
Right. And now what stuck with me for some reason in my college journalism was the big thing was yellow journalism and the chilling effect. The chilling effect always fascinated me. It was that idea that you could make pornography illegal rather than, you know, then you had to say what it was, and so that had a chilling effect. People might not produce good works because it might approach the idea of pornography, whereas the way we ended up was you create it, and then if it's seen as pornography, then you get attacked on that segment alone.
But that's also a cultural thing. That's society wanting censorship of what they consider immoral or something else culturally. And I think as a society, we have that right to have censorship.
But I think that censorship has caused, we talked about how, you know, our social culture progressed slowly. And yet, you know, it didn't always. In the 1960s, it was quick. And we're not going into the 60s today. But in the 20s, it was a very big change from the 10s. Related to some things, I think, that were caused by different rules and laws. But we do have jumps. But I think the culture is formed because we have these pre-recorded notions about what pornography is and what we should do in terms of religion. And so religion becomes so firmly established, not by the government, but by the people, that other people rebel and they end up with their own religion, which is kind of anti-religion.
But it's not always social, I mean, or religious. 1908 was when women suffragists started to campaign for women to get the right to vote. The women were still being arrested for smoking in public then.
Well, that is social.
I know. And in 1909, they organized to campaign against liquor. Took a decade, but those were not religious bases, but they were social. They were, you know, our society felt like, okay, we need to control these things, similar to censorship, but it was started in that first decade.
Yeah, and they That first decade was not a quiet decade. We look back on it and see it that way. A lot of things were happening, but we don't see the news back then as being, you know, as it being a riotous decade, and yet so much happened. So many new ideas were invented. You know, we think cell phones are wonderful because they're so complex, but think about the person who first thought of the idea of a phone of any kind. They had to come up with the idea before they managed to use the technology.
And we came up with automobiles. The first auto crossed the U.S. in 51 days in that first decade, and they thought that was monumental accomplishment, considering the roads we had then.
The roads and the vehicles.
Yes, and the Wright brothers brought us aircraft. They discovered oil in Alaska, but those things were tempered by all the other things that we got in our newspaper.
Right. And, you know, back then your local news was probably more important than the international news because it was so far away, or yes. Even your national news.
Yes. And Henry Ford, you know, when he created the first car company in the beginning of the century, that was changed society dramatically. But yet it was just a little seed that was planted only to affect us a decade or two later.
And what was interesting was it wasn't the technology that he created. It was the way to create the technology that caused this amazing revolution where all of a sudden, what did you say before, one out of six people had a vehicle back in the time when we considered everyone to be poor.
And that auto industry caused U.S. Steel to become the first billion-dollar company by J.P. Morgan because of the demand for the steel for automobiles.
And by the way, all this happened at the end of a depression.
This was actually the first decade of the 1900s that we're talking about.
And there was a depression up till 1898.
That's fine. We're talking about 1900s. 1907, corn was considered more valuable than gold and silver because we produce $1.7 billion worth of it every year.
Mm-hmm.
And farmers were was the richest year they had ever had was in 1909. So that goes back to the corn.
Yeah.
It's always been in our economy.
Well, it's always been whatever the current society needs. And there wasn't a lot of technology yet. So, I mean, now people go out and want to be the first to buy a new technology, even though that's the worst time to buy it. Back then, it was still about food. You know, people had to, you know, they couldn't do like, I get upset if I can't get fresh green vegetables in December.
Yes.
But these people, they still had to go search for food in a lot of ways and take whatever was there. So having that corn was a big deal.
And we take for granted having a banana or avocado in the store. That did not exist back then. All you had was grown locally in that community. And I mean small community. We're not talking the next city over or the next state. Whatever's grown in that community is the only thing you had available to eat.
Right. So that decade was quiet, but we had the airplane essentially invented. We had a process for mass producing things, much more than just the automobile. He invented an idea that affected all of the future.
The Industrial Revolution, yes.
Yeah, I mean, to be able to stamp out things identically like that is what gives us our cell phones and our electronics and all that. There has to be very high standards. And Henry Ford started that with an idea.
The one black eye that we have from that decade was child labor. 1.7 million kids were working in factories, and 200,000 of them were under the age of 12. And these kids worked just like adults, 12-hour days. And that needed to be corrected.
Well, kids were an asset in our agricultural days because they would work the farm for you when they got older, and they respected you because they couldn't get that farm from you unless you cared about them. So they were an asset to you financially. In the cities, when more people moved into the cities, the kids were not an asset unless they went to work in the factories. And so, you know, I know we think it's evil and so on, and maybe some of those employers had sweatshops, but the kids were doing what they had done. They worked them. Think how hard they worked on the farm. I don't know that the cities was a downgrade for them.
Well, that and think about it. At that point in time, primarily men worked in factories. And so kids could go to school. They weren't mandatory they go to school. So they could work on the farm. If they didn't want to work on the farm, they could go get a job in town in a factory. So it was an evolution of our society and the changing culture.
Right. Things changed, and there will always be people that take advantage of people who work for them. Generally, it works itself out, but there was some intervention needed, I think, because the disparity between the rich and the poor was already becoming wide by then.
Yeah, it wasn't until about 1918 when women started working in factories that they had fewer children working, and they established kindergarten schools for children back in about 1918. But ironically, the labor unions did not want to admit women into the labor unions. They felt that they were taking some men's jobs as well as teenage boys' jobs, and we didn't want kids working past the age of 14. We felt that they should still get an education. So that was a long time for that to be fixed.
Well, I think probably some of that union business was because men were afraid of women.
Could be.
We didn't want them into any of our clubs.
That's right.
That was our place to go for peace.
That's right. That was the man cave back then. The 1910 to 1920 era brought a lot of innovation. It brought medicine. They came up with the first cancer virus that they found in chickens. They found a microbe that they defined as cancer was actually a microbe. And they came up with the term vitamin to describe something that is a necessary chemical needed by human beings. They called it a vitamin.
And the whole vitamin industry took off.
And thank goodness. Yeah. We'll have that discussion another day.
Wonder how long before it was regulated.
Okay. They also busted up Standard Oil in that decade.
Right. That was the first monopoly breakup.
Yes, it was. The first Indy 500 race was ran.
And I had a grandfather who was a pit crew for one of those back in, I think, the early days of the Indy 500.
They sank the Titanic sank. Nobody sank it in 1912. L.A. started taking water from the Owens Valley. They created that aqueduct, and they took all the rights of water from that Eastern Sierra area, and it changed the whole culture of that community. Water was so important then to Los Angeles. That was the start of many, many decades of the chase for water from Southern California.
And you were talking about the current ramifications of that area being basically desolate now.
Yeah, the city of Bishop is there, and there's another couple of small communities, but they're unable to grow because all of the water rights have been sold to Los Angeles.
So
it restricted them, yes.
Yeah, that's a big example of... We're talking about the early 1900s, and we're talking about today, and that's why we're doing this program today, because we want to show the effects of all the decades on the succeeding years and into the current day.
And some of the other things that went on that you won't agree with, but the federal government started making regulations. They created the Federal Reserve in 1913. They passed the U.S. Income Tax, which was our 16th Amendment, and there are people that still believe the government does not have the right to tax us based on...
Those crazy people.
I know, and yet it is...
Specifically, it's the income tax that they created, because there were taxes before that.
Yes, but it's the income tax that we have lived with forever since then, and that was like 1913. Think about that. That's over 100 years we've been paying income tax to the government.
And most people who've been born in the last 30 or 40 years even have no idea that income tax has been something that they probably think it's been around forever, and yet it wasn't. It was artificially created.
And it is. We've been paying it for 100 years, and I, for one, object to many ways they spend that money. If only I could direct them how I wanted my portion of that spent.
I object to the idea of a federal income tax. A state, I think, should have a lot more freedom to do what it wants because you can leave the state. The federal income tax you can't escape, and we've seen what it does.
It continues to escalate.
As you said, it's another discussion for another day.
Anyway, those are some of the political things that happened here. But abroad, a lot was happening.
Yeah, World War I.
Germany was attacking Belgium and France. Eventually, they attacked Poland. Russia was attacking Austria over the Balkans at that time. Germany expected to be attacked by the Russians. England entered the war against Germany. And the French and the English attacked Turkey.
In many ways, World War One and even World War Two, to a degree, was still working out the baggage from the Roman Empire and from the Europe that came after the Roman Empire. And I'm sure World War One sooner or later would have happened in some form. But when Archduke Ferdinand and his wife were assassinated, it was kind of a fluke because the person who did the assassination was looking for someone to kill. Either them or another person, and they failed. The people were not where they were supposed to be, and later on, he stumbled on these two and assassinated them. It was an accident. It was just an opportunistic moment that happened.
And all of Europe was such a tinderbox at the time that this one spark actually created the war. And Russia eventually fell into civil war. The Cossacks were against the Bolsheviks, who Lenin was a big part of the Bolsheviks. And they executed the Tsar in 1918.
And this war was not a war of survival for us, as wars that came later. This was a war we went and were involved in. But it wasn't as big, even with the number of soldiers we lost, it wasn't as big in our social consciousness as World War II. World War II changed the face of the nation. World War I, it was kind of like a Vietnam or a Korea, where we were over there and we had troops, but there wasn't the resistance as much as there was in those other two wars I mentioned. And it just didn't change us the way the subsequent war did.
Right. And Lenin actually formed the Communist Russia in 1919. It had failed. Marx tried to do something along those lines in Europe in the 1800s, and it had failed. But Lenin finally, because of the Bolshevik revolution, he was able to make that a cohesive decision in Russia.
Well, reading the histories of them, Lenin actually didn't make it happen. He had people with him that were, you know, that believed in him, that really made it happen. And I think that gave some of the physical power and the political machinations that some of them were capable of. Stalin, who was deadly, was actually not that politically sophisticated at first. He kind of learned on the job. And he's the one that became kind of the figurehead for it because he was so brutal. But Lenin and Trotsky invented the idea.
Yes, and Lenin was, Russia was the Bolshevik revolution, and yet we in the United States in 1970 voted to go to war against Germany.
Right.
It wasn't against Russia.
No, it was, I think it was, and I don't really know why we picked Germany to go to war against.
Because they were invading the rest of Europe, small portions of Europe. They were also at war with other
it was probably an alliance thing, I think.
At that time, I don't know for sure.
And we had alliances.
Yes, we did. Anyway, that was that second decade was dominated by World War One. But we did have some interesting other things going on here. We had Einstein develop the theory of relativity. The United Artists Motion Picture Studio was founded. And so that was going to be a major impact in the next decade.
And Prohibition, we kind of skipped over, but that had an enormous effect on the next decade.
But
because
it passed in 1919, but it didn't take effect until 1920.
Right.
So, and that was women suffragettes that started that whole premise.
Right, and they did start it in the teens. And
yes.
And that movement led to it being, you know, they were just very strong about making it happen. So they made it happen. And the world would be a completely different picture if that hadn't happened. It even brought a lot of prosperity because crime always does. There's a lot of, you know, bleed from crime, economic bleed.
Well, ironically, 1916, President Wilson supported the women's right to vote, but that didn't happen for a long time after 1916.
Right, so there weren't really any economic implications. You always follow the money.
Yeah.
giving the women the vote when men were technically in control of most business, what did that help?
But we didn't get that vote for quite a long time.
No, because it's about the money.
Yeah.
Not to the women, but it was about the money. We're going to take a break in a moment. KKRN is hosting a pancake breakfast on Sunday, May 3rd from 8 to noon at the Mountain Community Center in Round Mountain. So that you have the gluten-free option with scrambled eggs, sausage, fruit juice, and coffee, they're going to have both corn and wheat pancakes. There will be real maple syrup, and the food will be wonderful. So if you want to support your station and have a great breakfast along with it, please attend the pancake breakfast on Sunday, May 3rd in Round Mountain at the Mountain Community Center. And we'll take a break now and be back shortly.
Give me a kiss to build a dream on, and my imagination will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this, a kiss to build a dream on. Give me a kiss before you leave me, and my imagination will feed my hungry heart. Leave me one thing before we part, a kiss to build a dream on.
Join the discussion. KKRN boasts a variety of talk radio, both from local and syndicated sources. We want to stimulate thoughtful and meaningful conversation. KKRN can offer more real conversation because we are supported by listeners. You have a voice.
Make them believe they're true. Oh, give me your lips for just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live.
The infinite possibilities of music are showcased by the eclectic panorama of song styles that you can find on KKRN Radio. You won't find our musical explorations on more mainstream commercially driven stations. From classic country to new age, from classic folk to classic rock, from blues to jazz, and music from outside our country. You'll find it all on KKRN listener supported radio, radio that makes you listen.
Welcome back to Examine Life, and before we get back, I want to remind you of the Whole Earth and Watershed Festival. It's going to be at City Hall on Cypress in Reading this Saturday. It's from 10 to 4. There's going to be free music on two different stages. They're going to performances from the Miracle Mile Records and the UPREP String Assembly, along with the Reading School of the Arts, plus many others. So plan on attending Saturday if you have nothing else to do.
We're talking tonight about the early decades of the 20th century, and I think we forgot to mention, but this theme that we're on may take us two or three shows to complete because we're going to cover the whole 20th and the beginning of the 21st.
Yeah, and there's even a lot to talk about in the 1920s. It was a very dramatic social impact on our society. The 1920s, women actually won the right to vote. And that bill was introduced by Susan B. Anthony. Ironically, women had the right to vote in Wyoming as early as 1869 within the state. And it was because there were so many pioneer women there that they represented a large portion of the population. So that was in 1920.
I wonder why so many pioneer women in Wyoming as opposed to elsewhere. That'd be an interesting thing to look into.
Well, probably because that's where the trail went from there to the west.
But I mean, they're usually pairs.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Now, in Utah at that time, or later times, maybe I could see more women than men, but
no,
not...
No. We won't go there either.
Okay.
But there were a lot of social implications because there were higher prices, there were shorter skirts, and what I mean by shorter skirts is they were now 4 inches above the ankle. And women started wearing short sleeves because the bra was patented in 1914. And up until then, everyone wore a corset. And once they started getting rid of the corsets, Things became very provocative. Clothing became provocative.
Not only provocative, but women became stronger because they could actually breathe.
Yes, that's true. And with they were empowered by this idea that they had the right to vote. Clothing, makeup, fans, and jewelry became very popular. And there was a lot of upheaval about the jiggling bodies in these clothes that was offensive to common decency. And this was creating a moral crisis.
I just think that's scandalous.
It was. And they even thought that it contributed to the divorce rate that was rising at the time.
When we look at the flappers in the 1920s and how scandalous people thought they were, and we look at today, and we realize it's all relative.
Well, up until then, women had corsets with waists, and the flapper dress skimmed the body. It had no waist or a dropped waist, and because it was very loose flowing type of fabric, it was clingy, and so they considered it indecent.
Well, and the way they danced and the way they acted, and women were more aggressive, and it was just a different scene. We were still in a male-controlled world, but women were liberated in certain ways.
And they tried to ban wearing perfume. They felt men wearing white pants was terrible because it was just not done up until then. Everybody wore black trousers and suspenders. So it was like women were corrupting the men. By 1925, there were silk stockings and garters, and that was replacing the old corset idea. And now hardly anyone wore a corset, and it was just horrific upheaval in society.
Excuse me. And I think some of it, too, was related to the to the fact that we had just before entered the more robust part of the industrialization, and so the cities were a bigger part of everything, and there was a lot more technology, and the technology adds to having bars and dancing places and the entertainment involved, and so we still have to look at invention as causing some of these things to happen. And even the production of alcohol was a lot more industrialized.
Well, we also had movies. The talkie movie was coming on scene. And even like Mae West in 1927 was arrested for indecency because of her play Sex. The name of the play was Sex. They closed down the theater. She spent 10 days in jail because women just were not allowed those kind of freedoms.
No, that's why everything those women in those places, the flappers and so on, was considered scandalous, and yet there were a growing number of those.
And the marathon dances became the rage, where people would go to a club, and it would be 48 or 52 or 60 hours of dancing nonstop in order to win these marathons. So this wasn't just a nightclub, nighttime thing. This was going on all day.
That prompted that Jane Fonda movie, They Kill Horses, Don't They? That was a marathon dance.
And ironically, they found that the male, the U.S. male, was now, the average was 5'8" tall. It was like that, you know, we've long passed that in the average height of a male.
Well, that's true. That's been the case kind of throughout history. I think when they talk about giants in ancient history, they're talking about people 6 foot tall, probably.
Yes. And we, at that time, the Americans had the highest standard of living up until that point in the early 1920s. But there were not so wonderful things happening in Europe. At that time, Adolf Hitler was the propaganda chief for the German Workers' Party. And that party started attacking Jews, Marxists, socialists, capitalists. And it was the war debts from World War I was hampering most of Europe. There was a lot of famine. And the Nazi Party got a foothold.
Thing that should sober us is that a lot of his power didn't come really from politics initially. It came from gangster-type activities, not gangster in the sense of our gangsters that we had back then, but it was the ruffians. You know, he started his movement essentially in bars and beer halls, and those are the kind of people that he brought into his fold, and they got most of what they wanted by intimidating people with the power of gangs. And we have a lot of gangs today.
And the prohibition took effect in 1920, and this actually caused other social things that almost identifies with what's happening with marijuana today. Doctors started prescribing alcohol as a medicinal remedy, and whiskey was selling for like $15 a quart, which was very expensive then. Does that not kind of smack of what's happening in marijuana in the last decade?
Well, it makes perfect sense, though. It's what people always do, which is why you shouldn't really ban anything except behavior.
And that's a social function,
it
not
is.
A government function.
Right. Well, it's true. Behavior should be banned within the Constitution. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And if you try to take that away from someone else, that's behavior, and that should be banned, and you should be taken out of society for that. But everything else, I don't think it should be banned. I think it should...
Well, it goes back to your rights and where mine begin. And if you're a drunk in public, you're offending me and you should be put away.
Well, I don't know if that's true. If I'm directly offending you, yes. But if I just drink myself into oblivion, I'm not really affecting you unless I'm driving a car or coming to your house or maybe if I'm out in front of your store. But those are all behaviors, not really alcohol. That's someone who's doing those behaviors, and it's directly affecting me. But just me being drunk shouldn't.
No, but it was becoming, you could not, they had what they call dry agents that were raiding saloons. Even beer was banned. You couldn't drink anything. You couldn't carry a hip flask full of alcohol. That was considered a crime.
You know what's interesting? I read about, I forget her name already, who started this movement to ban alcohol. They destroyed saloons before this was law. These women went around and they did. They destroyed, I think the last I heard was up to a certain point she had destroyed 14 saloons. And this was before it was banned. This was part of their movement. They would go into these places and wreck them.
And think about it. It was a way to get attention and get in the news headlines and bring more people, more women into the fold of trying to get that banned. And remember, alcohol was the most common vice of choice at the time. There wasn't illegal drugs on the streets back then. I mean, there might have been in isolated cases, but our war on drugs didn't occur until the 1970s.
No, the marijuana was around, but it just wasn't part of the things that concerned people.
Yeah, the other vice was smoking. That became an issue, but that was socially acceptable. It wasn't, no one knew that it harmed you, and it certainly wasn't what they considered intoxicating. And
right.
We later found out that it is addicting, but it's not intoxicating.
Right. So, it doesn't affect social behavior so much other than maybe blowing smoke on someone.
And the movies glorified smoking. And so it was something that was not only socially acceptable, it was actually popular. It was just women could not do it in public. They had to fight for that, right? And many, they got arrested for doing such things.
And that was interesting. I mean, you had in later movies, not in the 20s, but in later movies, you had, you know, Lauren Bacall and some women smoking because women were a little more free then. But you're right. It's funny how we kind of idolize smoking, and yet It was kind of cheesy of some way if a woman was smoking. It was like immoral.
Right.
And why would it be immoral for women and not for men? That always, I never had an answer to that.
And women were even flying airplanes then. You know, Lindbergh did cross the ocean, but women were starting to get their licenses to fly airplanes. In fact, 8 million women held jobs in 1920. And 2 million of them were married, but still, that's 8 million women had jobs. And 50% of that was teachers. So, and the medicine was not that big a field like it is today. In fact, medicine was, you didn't go to the doctor. The doctor came to your house.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't have all the need for nurses other than in hospitals. So only 7% of the workforce were nurses. 37% were still secretaries or clerical of some point. But 1,600 women were attorneys or lawyers.
Well, I think the agricultural societies of the past place the roles of men and women. They just made sense. And so during the 20s and the 30s and so on, we've just been gradually been coming out of that culture. As you previously said, it doesn't happen overnight. That culture was not really, quote unquote, bad. It was agriculture required roles to be set. But when we got into the cities, everything changed. It just took us a while to catch up.
And think about it. Women are coming into the cities and they're changing everything. They're making alcohol illegal, yet they're going to speakeasies and dancing. They're wearing headdresses and perfume. So even women who cut their hair, not their own, but if a woman bobbed another woman's hair, was what they called cutting your hair back then, she was supposed to have a barber's license because she was taking the job of a man.
You know, if you think about making alcohol illegal, it wasn't women who made alcohol illegal. It was a group of women who believed that it was evil and needed to be stopped, that it was bad for our morals and so on. And even though they weren't the government, they eventually brought the government in and got the laws changed, but they were meddling in things. If the Constitution would have been followed, the first time they destroyed a bar, I don't know if they were thrown in jail or not, but they should have been, and maybe the movement wouldn't have gotten anywhere, and we'd have avoided that whole thing which caused organized crime to become much more robust and much more well-funded. It was very destructive to make alcohol illegal, but that's not what they envisioned, and that's why you shouldn't meddle.
But their point, I believe, was if you go back, anything that gets abused gets regulated, and men's behavior got abusive, either on the streets or at home or at work or whatever, from excess alcohol. So their thought was the remedy to that is take away the alcohol and the boys will behave.
Right, which is why you shouldn't ban things, because usually your point of view is just by, it has to be, because we're limited human beings, it has to be too narrow. And they had no idea of the consequences.
But we had a lot of cultural changes taking place then.
We did.
Yes. I mean, even Chicago was having race riots. However, they had said that, you know, Jazz Satchmo was big in Chicago. Bessie Smith was the first black woman who did a recording of what they considered blues music. So there was a lot even changing in other communities. Harlem, in a newspaper article, had headlined, had the decade of the capital of Negro social and cultural life was at the Cotton Club. And this was in the late 1920s. They had made inroads into entertainment, and we were beginning to relax that stigma of segregation.
Right, and I think we would have come along. We needed the laws we had during the civil rights era because we still had some bad laws that were very prejudiced and bigoted. So we needed that, but we were making progress. In the first decade of the century was when the NAACP actually came about.
Yes. And so every segment of society was changing, even science and education. In 1925 was when Tennessee banned the teaching of evolution. And we actually had a trial of John Scoops, a teacher. He was found guilty because he was teaching evolution, which was considered a science, but the religious people felt that he was encroaching upon their beliefs.
And see, that, in my belief, is exactly the kind of thing that religion became. In a more subtle way, it happened in the 50s, which we'll talk about later. But I think that type of religious entrenchment, not in government, but in the society, caused the religiously fierce atheism we have today because of that entrenched religion being so strong-willed, it caused other people to rebel against it. And just now there's so many people that for some reason hate all Christians. And I think it goes back to that. But they're just doing the same thing that was being done to them.
But ironically, it was in the 1920s that Amy Semple McPherson opened the first temple that was a woman Pentecostal, Angelus Temple in Los Angeles. She was one of the first women to set up a religion, a church, a temple, and she eventually went on the radio.
Well, women are the perfect creatures for religion, I think, when you compare them to men. Women just have the sensibilities in my opinion, to make a religion work better. So she was filling a need, but you're right. The women were becoming able to do more and more things, even back then. Although it's so different from today, but back then it was a big difference.
But religion did not embrace that idea either. That didn't happen again for decades.
No, religions for a long time has been dogmatic, and it has been a power thing for many people. And I think that's a lot of why men wanted to keep women out. Religion is a power thing, and I think religions are wonderful things for a lot of people, but there are those that will project power in any venue of human undertaking.
But a lot of it was our freedom of religion that brought so many immigrants to the United States. And actually, in the 1920s, Ellis Island finally limited immigrants from Europe to 200,000 because they were having a famine over there and civil problems, particularly in Germany, they were having a lot of civil problems. And we were trying to limit the number of immigrants. We had so many of our own trying to find jobs and crowding the cities, and so it became a problem for us.
And the amazing thing that libertarians like myself want to talk about is that they didn't have any hope of having any kind of welfare benefits or anyone to take care of them. They were just going to have freedom, and that's what brought them all, was the freedom. They had no idea what was really going to happen when they got here. But they knew it was going to be free.
And there was a lot of distrust of immigrants because they often spoke another language. But their first goal was to learn English when they got here. My grandparents were immigrants, and that was one thing. You know, occasionally they would speak the foreign language at home, but by and large, you spoke English. Everybody spoke English. Everybody learned to speak English, even the old folks.
Right, and it made sense because, one nation, if you're all able to communicate together, things just happen better. A lot of bad things happen even today because people have a language that the people they're dealing with at the moment just don't know, and so bad things have happened completely unintentionally.
Well, if you're trying to get a job or you're trying to get an education, you have got to be able to communicate with those people that are hiring you or educating you, and it has to be in the language that they know.
And so I think when you talk about those immigrants coming in and we had to slow them down, they were coming to a great nation that had a great idea, this constitution of freedom, and the people control the government, not vice versa. That's what brought them all.
And our cities were just, gorging themselves with people. And for the first time ever, our urban population exceeded our rural population. Teenagers were leaving the farm because they were drawn to the motion pictures. They could come to the movies. There were good-paying jobs that they actually worked 8 or 10 hours a day, and then they were done. They had all these other freedoms that they did not have on the farm.
Yeah, the things did change with the city. And when we talk about those kids working in the factories, that was true. But it was just part of the adjustment to moving into the cities. And as things progressed and people progressed, there are still people now, even though, we have so many benefits that no one really has to work. There are still people who work two jobs and work 12 hours a day. And so when we talk about the kids in the sweatshops, it's not all that new of a concept, and it's still around, and it's considered being productive. I've had two jobs more than once in my life.
And rural living has never gained again. It's been cities continue to grow in population. They offer all the advantages. Back then, remember, farms didn't have running water or electricity necessarily. Kids wanted those motion pictures. They wanted to listen to the radio. And the radio was predominantly, you plugged it into the wall. So you wanted to go where there was electricity and you could listen to the radio.
Right. And, it's just a natural thing. People want to entertain their senses. So when they were in the country, they did as much as they could. They sang, they read, they'd have dances. But people have always wanted to be entertained. So it just became natural when you had the city and you had more options to be entertained, you would partake of them.
And think about it. If you went to the movies in the city, okay, even if you were a farm kid, you went to the movies maybe once every few months in the city, and there was Will Rogers. He was a great big star then, and he winds up on a radio talk show. So he's got a little radio show that goes on, and everyone gets hooked. It's It's a form of entertainment.
He's reaching a lot more people. I guess I'm old-fashioned, but on satellite radio, there are old radio shows, and they're still entertaining. And I'm kind of hard to entertain. I'm a big fan of modern science fiction. But some of the old shows are just fun to listen to, and, you know, you can imagine when you listen to a radio.
In 1927, Al Jolson was in the first talkie picture. Laurel and Hardy, you know, the comedy of that era was slapstick, the Charlie Chaplin type idea, but it was entertainment. If it was talking or sound or not, it was still another form of entertainment you didn't have on the farm.
Well, the humor wasn't as sophisticated, and I think having television and theater is what allowed humor to become sophisticated. When you look at the slapstick comedy, and actually that was named after an actual device. It was a stick that had two parts, and they were flexible, and you would slap it and make a slapping sound when someone hit someone else. But I digress. But the humor became more sophisticated, but people had always laughed at other people bumbling, so that's what humor became in the first movies and TV programs, even radio programs.
The shows, the movie pictures became a phenomenon. And it was a nickel. It was relatively inexpensive form of entertainment. And there were also the bands were becoming popular. The Ellington's band was on the streets. It was something that you could go and enjoy day or night. You could find some sort of entertainment that you could never find out on the farm.
Duke Ellington and that those scandalous big band music.
Yeah, that was yet to come. It was still just, you know, beginning in the clubs at night. It wasn't yet on recordings and popular like it became in the 30s and 40s.
Right, but the music of the 20s was scandalous to the generation before the 20s.
Well, it was very fast-paced, and it was jumping around. It was not the, you know, waltz-type idea that people were jumping and kicking, and, you know, the flappers are, you know, quite risque
right.
in appearance when you watch them dance. And so it was something that society was not really accepting of.
Well, the older society. The new
right.
generation embraced it,
that's
and they
right.
always have.
But the establishment was the older generation. That was the biggest part of the population. So they were the ones that were in control of social behavior, and they felt that that was not acceptable. And think about dance historically. We don't have every decade with a new dance. You had the flappers and the dancing and all of that, but then you didn't really have any dance other than the waltz idea of big bands until rock and roll hit. And then you had another decade of all kinds of different dances. So,
well, I mean, in the 20s, some of the dancing got pretty risque.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Between the 20s and the 60s, you didn't have a whole lot of variable in dancing.
What happened there is what we were talking about earlier before the show, in that the Depression changed people's morals. When you need to start making sure that you have food on the table, everything changes. And that's why I always think it's a good thing that people don't automatically know that they're going to be fed every day. I think it's a good thing that people have to go out and make that happen every day. And that changed our morals, and it took a long time for that to come back around to the 50s, and then the 60s was just a big rebellion.
Yes. I want to touch base on a couple more things, and that was we did have a black eye in that era also that was society-wide, and that was the KKK.
Yeah,
they were a million strong just in Oklahoma, and the governor there used martial law against the KKK, and they actually impeached him. And in 1925, 40,000 KKK members marched on the U.S. Capitol demanding that, you know, their right to protest and to be bigoted.
Well, blacks were bigoted against all through the country still, but in the South, they were still hating the fact that blacks had the freedoms of everyone else. So it just took them a long time to recover.
And that Duke Ellington and the bands and the Harlem and the Cotton Club that were getting a lot of notoriety was resented in the South particularly. And that was a black eye on that decade. But we did make advances in science.
Well, we made a lot of advances. People don't think of that way back then, but a lot of the things we have now are directly related. As I said earlier, without Einstein's theory of relativity, a GPS would not work.
Right. And they had Calvin Coolidge, President Calvin Coolidge, his son actually died of blood poisoning, which was turned out to be what we call today appendicitis. But they had no cure or any fix. Surgery was not a common thing then. So he died of what they called blood poisoning.
Right. And that's science has progressed so fast in this century, because when you think about back then, there's still so much we know about the body now that we didn't know back then, and how much different it is now, the things that we have. And so science progressively moves faster and faster. But back then, we were still in the dark ages of medicine in a lot of ways.
Yes, they had just invented the electrocardiogram to try and track what was happening with the heart. And in 1928, Alex Fleming discovered in an uncovered culture of bacteria that mold killed the bacteria.
Right.
And that was the start of what would become
penicillin.
That's right. That would eventually become our antibiotic of choice.
Yep. And as everything else, it has a plus and a minus, because now we're using them so much that we've created resistant bugs.
And I don't want to leave this decade or the show without talking about Wall Street. In the early 1920s, it became a boom. And in 1927, GM, who owned Chevy at the time, paid the highest dividend ever. And that in 1928, there were three record-setting days of just volume of business. And that was before the crash. And in December of that year, we had Black Thursday, which would eventually lead to the crash and a depression. But we'll have to touch base on that next time, our next show.
That's right. And don't forget about the pancake breakfast on May 3rd.
And this Saturday, the Whole Earth and Watershed Festival, which has some great booths there. Even if you don't go for the music, walk around and look at those booths. I've gone in the past, and it's very educational. You can find out all kinds of things about our environment, water, solar, all kinds of things.
So come and meet your radio station and give them your opinion about what you want to hear on the air. We really need to know what you want to hear out there.
There will be two or three representatives at the KKRN booth, and you can walk up and talk to them at any time.
This has been Examine Life on KKRN. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We'll have a couple more in the same vein, talking about different decades of the 20th century. We hope you've enjoyed it. We've enjoyed bringing it to you.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Steve.
Good night.
Good night.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Métis Nation of Saskatchewan, Canada has closed its doors. The president of the organization that represents about 100,000 Métis in the province says it comes after political infighting.